I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by our friends at Oddvisor. If you like the podcast, but are looking for a shorter, faster way of feeding your brain with some similar nuggets, Oddvisor is perfect for that. I've recorded some insights of my own on what makes great interviews, how to build communities, what makes things unmistakable, and much, much more. And they've been our sponsor for the entire quarter, so we'd be really grateful if you showed them your support by checking out the app. It's available on both the Android and the iPhone, and it's completely free. Now, let's get into the episode. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, I speak with author, educator, and executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program, Tina Seelig, about why most rules are just recommendations, the power of writing a resume of your failures, reframing problems to give us an expanded set of solutions, and much more. Tina, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So, I came across you through the work of yours that I've read in various publications, and of course, through the Stanford Entrepreneurial Thought Leaders series, which I happen to be a big fan of it. And I'm just really, really curious about, you know, the work that you do. You seem to me like somebody who's a linchpin of our educational system, and that's why I wanted to have you here. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your journey, your background, and how that has led you to this sort of unusual view and perspective on education that you seem to have?
How much time do you have? My story is somewhat convoluted, as probably most people's are. I started my career as a neuroscientist. I did my undergraduate work in neuroscience, where I crafted my own major, and then I came to Stanford for my PhD in neuroscience, and I always expected that I would be a scientist. But I realized when I was in the lab that I really wanted the product of my work to not just be research papers. I really wanted to have things get out into the world. In fact, it's kind of interesting that that's my new book, is focused on getting ideas out of your head and into the world. You know, that was my frustration way back when I was a graduate student, was, gosh, I really want to have a bigger impact. And so I used to go hang out at the business school when I was at Stanford and sit in the back of the room in the strategy classes trying to get a sense of how you did this. Well, my life then took, you know, some interesting paths. I was on the original team for the Tech Museum in San Jose. I was a management consultant for a couple of years at Booz Allen. After I was there for a couple of years, I started a family, and that lifestyle was not conducive to being a consultant and being a new mom. So I left and I wrote my first book. And my first book was on the chemistry of cooking. It's called The Epicurean Laboratory. And that book, I started writing it actually when I was in grad school, because I was fascinated by what was happening in my kitchen and had no idea what was actually going on from a scientific perspective. And so I made a list of all the questions I had and decided I should try to find the answers. Now, back in those days, the book came out in 1991. Mm-hmm. And in those days, you know, there wasn't such a wealth of information about the chemistry of cooking that there is today. And so I figured I had to write a book. So the long story short, I ended up writing this book when I was pregnant. And after it came out, I said, you've got to be kidding. There's got to be a better way to market books. Have you ever written a book?
I just got a book deal with Penguin, so I'm in the process of doing it. And I've self-published a book. So, yeah.
So you know that, you know, especially in those days before there was social media, you know, publishers basically left the book on the doorstep and kind of waited for people to find it. You know, it was sort of like leaving the baby there and hoping someone would discover it. And I got somewhat frustrated and decided to start my first company. And so it was a company that was called Book Browser, which was a precursor to Amazon. And it was designed, it was before the web, it was a kiosk-based system for bookstores. And it was designed to match books with buyers. And it's interesting, I'm not going to go into all the details, but I did a lot of the right things for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. But I was quite successful early on. Essentially, I did all my customer development. I had no money to spend. So I did all my customer development first. I got all the publishers to agree that if I built this product, they would buy the space on it. Essentially, publishers paid per title per month to have their books listed in the system. And I got all the bookstores to commit to having this system in their stores if I built it. So I had all my customers lined up before I even started. And so anyway, I built that company, and I'm not going to go into all the details, but essentially I had set a goal for myself of building a company and selling it in 2 years. I wanted to prove I could do that. Mm-hmm. And guess what? That's what I did. But it was so early. I mean, it was such a huge missed opportunity because I sold it. And a year later, Netscape started. And I said, oh my gosh, this is what we need to do. We need to put this online. That solves all the problems. And now the fellow who owned the company didn't want to do that. Hmm. He didn't want to compete with his customers for who were independent booksellers. So anyway, it's a long story. I left there. I became a multimedia producer at Compaq. We were designing kids' multimedia games. That place actually exploded, totally exploded. I left. I went back to writing books. I wrote a dozen kids' books, and after my son was, you know, really launched in school, I decided I wanted to go back to work. And I went, and the rest is history, because 16 years ago, I went to Stanford to help my wonderful colleague Tom Byers build the Stanford Technology Ventures Program, and I went from being the assistant director to being the director to being the executive director, and a couple years ago, they made me a real professor. So for the last 16 years, I've really been focused both in the classroom and meeting with executives and entrepreneurs, really focused on how do we really foster innovation and entrepreneurship. So I hope that story wasn't too long for you.
No, actually, there's plenty more that I want to dig into. But one of the big questions that I have for you is that moment of realization that you wanted to have a bigger impact. And I'm really interested in why you had the realization so early in your life, because I feel like so many people don't. I couldn't have come up with any of those kinds of realizations when I was that young.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me sort of put another spin on it. When I was in the lab, I loved thinking about the science. I loved the big ideas, but I didn't love the tactical, you know, experience of being in the lab all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I really felt like, boy, if you instantly made me the department chair, I'd be super happy. I don't really, I just want to like work my way up. And, you know, I watched my colleagues who spent all their time just writing grants. So the whole lifestyle of being a bench scientist was not a great match for me. And I really did love the big ideas and the looking at the landscape from that perspective, as opposed to the tiny little, you know, experiments that one does when one is in the laboratory.
Hmm. Well, I mean, you're exposed to people that are that age on almost a daily basis. And I'm really interested in, you know, what kinds of potential missteps and mishaps and mismatches in terms of what they think they want their life to be, do you see when you see these sort of young and incredibly hungry people?
Yeah, there are some really interesting characteristics. And we can sort of break it down into lots of different categories. There are those students who come in and have their life planned for the next 50 years. I can absolutely point to specific students who come to my office with a roadmap. And you look at them and you say, where's the room in this for serendipity? Mm-hmm. You know, where is the room here for the possibility of stumbling upon something that's really exciting to you that's not on this path? And that's really shakes them, because their life so far has been such that they, you know, they really want a roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one extreme. The other extreme is those people who are just, they're afraid that they don't have anything they're passionate about. And they're searching deep inside of themselves for their passions, and they don't realize that their passions actually follow their engagement, not the other way around. Mm. And this is super important. This is one of the insights I share in this book, Inside Out, is that your experiences lead to your passions, not that your passions lead to your experiences. So you can be doing anything in your life, and if you're paying careful attention, you start realizing there are opportunities for you to make a difference and for you to really have an impact. But you'd never know that until you actually got out there. And this is why many, many of our successful students, many, and I could, you know, list examples, finish in our programs, and then it's 5 years later that they decide to start a company.
Mm-hmm.
So people say, well, gee, give us an example, you know, people who start companies when they're in school. And we say, wait, please don't look at that. Because, you know, the things that they're going to come up with are going to be really incremental and small. It's only once they've gotten out in the work world and are actually immersed in industry,
mm-hmm.
they're really going to see the opportunities where they can have an impact. So those are two examples of things, you know, that those who are afraid, you know, who want a roadmap, those who feel that they're not passionate. And a third category is those people who are so afraid to fail. They are They've done everything right. They look at the world as a place where there's one right answer.
Uh-huh.
And so when they get out of school, guess what? There's not one right answer. And they don't know what that should look like. And they are afraid that if they do something wrong, that they're going to be in trouble, as opposed to understanding that life is messy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be a lot of stumbling along the way, and all of those provide data that get you to the next step.
Okay, so I want to talk about all three of those in a bit more depth. One is the people with the roadmap, and it's funny because I know you tweeted the article that I wrote on Medium about why the greatest work of your life will require a compass, not a map.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in why you think it is that these people come into this system with a roadmap and are so hell-bent on following it. Yeah, and how you start to break that.
Yeah, well, because that's what they've been taught in school up until then. I mean, nobody ever criticizes you for getting an A on an exam. Nobody ever criticizes you for going to Stanford or Harvard or Yale or pick your school.
Right.
Nobody ever criticizes you for going to college.
Uh-huh.
So all of a sudden they get to a point where they get to the precipice and they're looking out in the world and there's no right answer. And no one has taught them how to even find that compass. I mean, I love that article you wrote. And one of the things that I talk about a lot in some of my other books, especially my book I wrote called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, is about the fact that most rules are just recommendations. And yet people, and especially young people, are looking for the rules. It's quite funny when I'm teaching undergrads, this happens all the time. I have to break them of the habit of thinking that there's actually a rule that they have to follow and that they get to actually make their own rules.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're the customer, right? They go into the university and guess what? You know, they get to pick their own path through this experience. It's a choose your own adventure as opposed to a follow someone else's story.
Hmm.
So the issue that people have is they're afraid that they don't even know how to find their compass. And so that's one of the things that, you know, I really focus on in our classes is helping students look inside themselves, but also to get the experiences that are going to allow them to really figure out what drives them.
So one of the things that's interesting to me is that this kind of thinking was not at all a part of the way I was educated. And, you know, I went to that other school across the bay that you know of. And part of me wonders if it's because of the fact that I went to school when I did and times have really changed and it just wasn't possible then. So I'm interested actually in how you start to break this kind of conditioning in adult life, because I think plenty of people have kept the conditioning you're talking about and the need for a map long after they've left school.
Yeah. So the key is getting out of your comfort zone. And you can do that in really simple ways, right? It doesn't have to be, you know, jumping out of an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
You can pick up some books to read that are in a topic that you haven't read before. It's funny, recently I've been doing that myself. I have never been a fan of opera. And I said, you know what? I'm going to listen to opera. I'm going to figure out, like, I'm going to listen. I'm going to pay attention and see what is in this that people like. And I'm going to figure out if there's something in here like, I'm going to try to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just an example. Get out of your comfort zone. Do something. You know, listen to a different type of music. Travel somewhere that you've never been. Introduce yourself to someone and start a conversation. So all of these things really stretch you and allow you to realize, you know, this doesn't really hurt very much. Mm-hmm. Let me try something else that's new.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because I think that we have this idea that these have to be gargantuan leaps when we say step out of your comfort zone. And yet it's the smallest things that start to cause us to experience the growth that we need to have in order to start making changes in our lives.
Exactly. And I discussed this in detail in Inside Out,
mm-hmm.
is that whole creative process starts with motivation that leads to experimentation.
Hmm.
And a little bit of motivation can lead to little experiments. You know, think of them as prototypes or even pretotypes. I don't know if you've heard that term.
Mm-mm.
I have a colleague, Alberto Savoia, who invented that term pretotype, which is sort of a pre-prototype. And the idea of doing really little experiments, therefore, if they don't work out, you know, really there's no big loss. This is a huge issue, though, you're bringing up, is that people, so here's the thing. Someone comes up with an idea, I want to start a company, and they imagine their name in lights on this big building, they look at Google, and they don't realize this started with, you know, a couple people in an office or a garage.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we read in the newspaper about these people who have been so successful, and they don't always see the root of all the little experiments and the failures along the way to get to that big success.
Yeah. I jokingly say all I did was plug a microphone into a laptop and start recording MP3 files. And here we are 7 years later.
Right. And another example of that would be, Sal Khan with Comedy. Uh-huh. I spoke with him extensively about his process of getting the organization launched. And he also went through the same process, right? It started out as an experiment while he had a day job.
Mm-hmm.
And it built enough momentum that he said, you know what, there's actually something here. And that's when he finally left his job to launch the venture. But it was done on the side as a series of experiments.
Hmm. Well, let's do this. Let's talk about this whole fear of failure idea and why it's such a integral part of our culture. I mean, I come from a culture, being Indian, where that whole fear of failure has been ingrained into me since I was old enough to get a letter grade. Like, we didn't get our report cards put on fridges. We got asked why we got an A-. And I mean, you being at Stanford, I'm sure you're exposed to people like this on a daily basis. So I'm really interested in breaking that conditioning. And, I remember actually where I first came across your work, now that we're talking about this. I remember you had I think it was on a Fast Company article about creating a resume of your failures. So I actually did that exercise.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite exercises, is having students write failure resumes of all their biggest screw-ups, personal, professional, and academic.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, of course, you can imagine they're really delighted to do this. But I get letters from people from years in the future, who say, thank you. They continue to do this. Even if they don't do it, physically write it down, it's something that's in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly do it myself. Is, if I have a day where I've really messed up or I really am disappointed with something, a choice I made, instead of spending my time beating myself up, I go, okay, that's something on my failure resume. And what do I learn from it? That's the key.
Right.
What do I learn from it? It's a fascinating to think about the fact that we expect kids to make mistakes, right? Nobody gets up and walks the first time they try. Nobody gets up and rides a bicycle the first time. Why do we expect adults who are doing super complicated things to do something really hard without any errors the first time through? And so it's a very strange thing that happens. And what you talked about with, the grades and your family celebrating your successes and if you're perfect, really giving you a hard time. One of the things that I am very, very passionate about is helping people tap into their internal motivation as opposed to their external motivation. In fact, in the classes I teach, I will never talk about grades. I tell the students, if you ever ask me about your grade, I'm going to get very upset. I assume that you are motivated to do a great job. I am going to put in everything I have into this course to create an amazing experience for you. I'm assuming that you're going to put in the same level of engagement, and I'm sure it's going to all work out. So let's not focus on grades. Let's focus on the experience that we're all going to have. One of the things I talk about in my book, What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, is the idea that at the beginning of the first class, I tell the students to never miss an opportunity to be fabulous. And I say this once, but it's an amazing thing that this concept is so sticky. People, in fact, I'm sitting in my office, I have a poster that one of the students made for me that says, never miss an opportunity to be fabulous. I have students show me that on the back of their, iPods, they have carved, never miss an opportunity to be fabulous. People use it as the screensaver for their computer. And the reason is they are waiting for someone to give that instruction to them. They're waiting for someone to say, do your very best. Don't do just enough to get an A.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you do just enough to get an A, you basically just satisfice. You do, okay, you got an A. But where's the moonshot in that? So I really try to encourage students to really think of everything they do as an opportunity to be their very, very best.
Okay, so I have a couple of questions around this.
Okay.
Why do you think that this kind of thinking and this mindset isn't universal throughout our education system? Again, part of the reason why I wanted to have you here is I see you as somebody who is a linchpin in our education system. Like, I wish I had had you as a teacher when I was at Berkeley. And that's why I wanted to talk to you. And then the other thing is, what is it that keeps these people waiting to be fabulous? Why are they waiting for a nod of approval?
Yeah, there's a huge problem with our education system. And the problem has to do with the way we measure things, right? That teachers and schools have to have some metrics, and they use grades. And there's some things that are easy to measure, right? If I give you a multiple choice exam, that's going to be an easy way for me to test whether you know the information. If I give an essay exam, it's going to be a little more subjective, right? If I just have to watch what you're going to do in 10 years from now, that feels impossible, right? And so what happens is we're measuring the things that aren't relevant. There's a great Einstein quote, and I wish I had it perfectly, but it's something to the effect of, all things that count can't be counted, and not all things that can be counted count. And that's really profound. I mean, how do you measure love? How do you measure ethics? How do you measure entrepreneurship or creativity? You know, so the fact is, it's really hard to measure whether your students have great values, whether they're good people, whether they're ethical, whether they're really creative. And therefore, we choose not to measure those things because they're hard to measure. Right? And so this is the problem, is that so we end up in the situation where we measure the things that are easy to measure, and those might not be the things that we actually really value in the long run.
Okay, so I think that makes a perfect setup to talk about our next question. You know, one of the things you said earlier was that you did a lot of the right things for the wrong reasons, and you've made reference to this book, you know, What I Wish I Knew in My 20s. And part of me is interested in, one, do you think that you could have known those things in your 20s without having gone through the things you did and made the mistakes you did? And what were the mistakes and what were the lessons?
Really good question. Could I? So when I say what I wish I knew when I was 20, could I actually have known those things when I was 20? Well, I think I could have. I think if someone had taught me these things, they're not so complicated. But our system is not set up to allow you to learn these things. So some of the lessons in that book are about, or the insights from that book is that, you know, most rules are recommendations. Well, we're in schools and we're environments where they make the rules, and we get tricked into thinking that those are the rules. Well, I have never gotten a job or never even gotten into school, you know, in a way that anyone else did. I have always found another way around to get where I want to go. But most people find the barriers that are put in front of them, you know, oh, wow, I can't get around that. Whereas really, you know, you can just turn around and go the other direction. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is why I loved your article about a compass as opposed to a map, right? That give me a compass. Tell me help me figure out where I want to go. Guess what? Then I'm going to figure out how to get there. Mm-hmm. If my goal was to get from here to New York, how many ways are for me to get from here to New York? An infinite number of ways. Right? Someone might not tell me I should hitchhike, but that's certainly an option.
Might be more interesting than driving.
It might be. I might meet some really interesting people.
Yeah.
Maybe I take all the little side roads. That's going to open up some interesting opportunities. Of course, you know, the flight might be canceled, but that shouldn't get in the way. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can teach people earlier to be much more flexible in their thinking, to realize that they have much more agency in their life. And that they are responsible for making their own luck, that they need to reframe things. That's what I spend most of the time in my classes teaching, is teaching people how to reframe the problems that are in their lives. Do you want me to give you just a simple
example? Yeah, absolutely.
A simple example. So this is one I like to use because it's so poignant and easy to understand. Let's say we have a friend who has a birthday next week. And we say, hey, let's plan a party. Let's brainstorm to come up with the best birthday party for the friend. Sound like a good idea?
Yeah.
Super. Okay, so we're going to brainstorm this. If I change one word in that prompt to let's plan a birthday party to let's plan a birthday celebration, what happened to the set of solutions?
Wow.
It expanded dramatically.
Yeah.
Right? What if I had said, let's not plan a birthday party or a celebration. Let's find the best way to mark this person's birthday.
Wow.
Again, we've now totally expanded the set of solutions. And the fact is, the answer was baked into the question. When we said that we were going to plan a party, it assumed it was a party. Mm-hmm. When we said it was a celebration, we assumed it was that. The questions we ask are the frame into which the answer will fall. And so really what we need to do is framestorm before we brainstorm. Hmm. We need to actually do a brainstorm around the question we're asking before we even look at the solutions. And this is one of the things that people make a bit mistake, or that one of the things that can be learned and that we can teach people younger in their lives is to question the questions they're even asking.
There's more of my conversation with Tina Selig after this short message from our sponsors. You've heard me mention Oddvisor at the beginning of the episode. It's like having access to a personal set of mentors, advisors, and consultants right there in your pocket. Whether you're looking for advice on how to come up with a tagline for your brand, how to manage your time more effectively, or how to become a better presenter, Oddvisor can help. So be sure to check out the app and let them know what you think by tweeting them or mentioning them on Facebook. Whether it's learning how to hack your productivity or discover the power of storytelling, you're curious enough to want to learn from the people who actually know what they're talking about, the experts. That's why the like-minded folks at Marketing Profs have put together a marketing writing bootcamp. They know that if you're a marketer, and honestly, even if you're not, your job mostly likely involves writing, and you could probably stand to be better at it. Heck, we all could, right? This course will cover all aspects of writing, and is taught by some of the best and brightest minds in the world of marketing writing. You'll learn to write with a relentless focus on your customer, because in the end, that's what it's all about, your customer. The classes are available online and on demand, so just like the podcast, you can learn from your computer, your tablet, or smartphone, whenever and wherever works best for you. And as a special offer to Unmistakable Creative listeners, visit mprofs.com/unmistakable and use the promo code unmistakable to save $200 when you register for the Marketing Writing Bootcamp. Plus, you'll get over $1,000 worth of seminars, classes, and video tutorials just for free for registering. Now, back to the show. Okay, so I have a couple of questions about that. One is applying this later in adult life when we've become so conditioned into asking a certain set of questions, how we bring that about. And then the other question it raises for me, I mean, since we're talking about, you know, earlier and sort of younger and formative years for you in all this journey. And again, you know, I keep asking people these questions and I wonder half the time if I get an answer because I'm asking it or because it's a universal truth. Have there been any sort of rock bottom, dark night of the soul experiences throughout this for you?
Oh my God. So which question do you want me to answer?
Let's go with the first one first and then the second one.
Okay. The second one was I think the question was about
basically taking that, you know, question, the idea of changing the questions once we've been so conditioned to not see alternatives and opportunities.
Yeah. So I have been fortunate enough to teach several online classes and so with, you know, thousands of people around the world. And the participants in these classes are adults. I mean, they range from, you know, the average is like 25, but to, you know, 85 years old. And so these are grownups who are out of school. And not only do they thrive with the type of projects that I give, they are hungry for them. They say this has changed the way they approach everything in their life. And so what I do is I teach specific tools for doing this. And they're not complicated, but they do force you to think differently. Like, how do you reframe the problem? How do you challenge assumptions? How do you connect and combine ideas? How do you work with people effectively on creative teams? So, by giving them some guidance on how to do this and then giving them opportunities. So oftentimes the projects I give are quite playful. I want to come up with things that are relevant for people around the world. So I might give them a simple object like a loaf of bread or a handful of rubber bands and say you need to create as much value as possible, value measured in any way you want, starting with this item. So it forces them to look at the things around them with fresh eyes. Mm-hmm. So if I have a loaf of bread, and the reason I picked a loaf of bread is I figured, you know, everyone in every culture, you know, has a loaf of bread sitting on their table. And I want them, even after the course, every time they see that loaf of bread, to be reminded of all the things that you could do with a loaf of bread. Or every time they're sitting at their desk and see a rubber band, they're reminded that, oh my gosh, you know, look at the infinite number of things that I could do with a rubber band. So that's the sort of things, you know, that might seem mundane, but the idea is to stretch your thinking in an everyday way so that when you then approach bigger problems, you're actually prepared to look at those problems in the same way. Hmm.
Okay. What about the second question?
The dark night of the soul?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It depends what you're talking about. I have had many, many challenges along the way. And the challenges are personal, professional, and academic. You know, and I'm just like everybody else. One of the things I made the decision to do, and it was a bit of a risk that I took, but in my new book, Inside Out, I shared the fact that at the end of this last year, I hit bottom. And I had to take a month off for medical leave. And you're wondering, wow, why, how did that even have to do with putting it in the book? But there's a chapter in the book about persistence and about pushing through barriers to get where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And this is something we always hear about entrepreneurs who keep working and working and working and, you know, push through all of the things that seem like incredible, immovable obstacles. But at some point, you need to know your limit. And that's what I did. I found my limit. You know, I pushed myself so hard that I literally collapsed. I found myself in the emergency room twice in 3 days. My doctor took one look at me and said, "You have to stop." So I realized that we all need to understand our own limitations and to take care of ourselves. You know, there's the old saying, put on, you know, your own oxygen mask before you help others. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was so focused on helping everybody else and doing everything everybody else wanted from me that I had forgotten about taking care of myself.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I ask the question is because, you know, I've started to see all these articles sort of you make their way around the web about founder depression and all the other things that go on. And you know, part of the reason this is so interesting to me is I had a friend who happened to also be a Stanford grad student. And he said, you know, he said, you do something really hard. He said, your entire self-worth is based on the fluctuation and performance of the work that you do. Whereas at a day job, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. In fact, when I was a grad student, I used to say that being a PhD student, and I'm going to say an entrepreneur as well, is a perfect model for the onset of manic depression. I kid you not. It is true, because when you're so judged by outside things that are outside of your control, mm-hmm. and things that you feel like they should be under your control. And so you're often in a situation where things are going great, and so you feel great, and then when things go badly, you feel horrible. So I know that very, very well, and had to really, really do some deep soul searching to understand how to deal with that, the ups and downs, and how to come up with find a calm spot that I could go to when things became very, very difficult. Huh. Because this is hard, actually. I mean, you know, we think of creativity, innovation, entrepreneurship, you read about it in the paper, it all looks very romantic. But when you look up close, it is a very hard process to push beyond the expectations, to do things that often other people think are crazy, mm-hmm. and to build a market for something that doesn't exist.
Yeah. Have you seen this happen in the lives of the students that you've taught, like seen them go through this roller coaster and seen them navigate it? And how have you seen them come out of the other side of it better?
Yeah. So it's really interesting. And I found that, this last winter quarter is when I got sick and had to take time off. And I was teaching. I mean, I was middle of the quarter. And I co-teach my classes, so my colleagues were wonderful in terms of filling in when I couldn't be there. But I went to every one of my classes once to talk to the students about what happened to me and how difficult things were and how I was dealing with it. And it ended up being the most meaningful quarter to me and to them. My teaching scores were off the charts. And the letters I got from students thanking me, because, you know, you've probably heard about the duck syndrome at Stanford. Do you know about the duck syndrome?
I think so.
You know, it's where basically on the surface, everybody looks perfectly calm and normal, but underneath they're feeling like crazy to stay afloat. Uh-huh. And that they realized that they too were dealing with this, you know, and many of them said they were really struggling with the same types of things and were so appreciative that I was able to share this and talk about the ways that, that I was thinking about coping with it. In fact, I came up with a metaphor that I shared with them about what really goes on. Do you want me to share with
you?
Yes,
absolutely.
So the metaphor is that we're all little sailboats sailing around on a little ocean. And the wind comes up and goes down, and the sailboat is perfectly happy on this ocean. And every day it rains to fill up the ocean, and every day the sun comes out and evaporates the water. And this is all well and good if you keep replenishing the ocean, if the rivers keep feeding it, if the rain keeps coming. But at some point, if you don't keep replenishing this ocean, the water level keeps going down. This is a perfect metaphor for the California drought, I guess. The water just keeps going down. And you can convince yourself you're fine because you're just sailing around on this ocean and it feels like it's okay, but the cliffs on the side keep getting higher and you keep getting lower. Eventually, you hit bottom. And there's a mountain range underneath this ocean, and everybody has a different mountain range. Some people, the top things you hit are depression or anxiety. Other people, it's going to be stomach aches or headaches or getting a sore throat. I mean, the fact is, as soon as you hit bottom, the thing that is your weakest link basically becomes manifest. And it takes a long time to replenish this ocean. It is not something that happens right away. You need to really, really put effort into replenishing it. And you also need to fix your little damaged sailboat. And I really felt that. It took me quite a long time, at least a couple of months, before I was able to kind of get back in the water.
I can only imagine how that's gone over with like total type A students who are really overachievers in their lives.
Yeah, but you know what? What do you think?
I agree. I mean, I agree completely.
They basically are so appreciative that someone is saying, you're not the only one who's dealing with this. Uh-huh. I think we just have to all give ourselves a break.
Yeah.
You know, we need to understand that what we're trying to do is really hard, and to create some balance in our life to make sure that we actually stay healthy through the process.
So I want to ask you a question that a photographer I had here asked, you know, had mentioned to me. You know, he asks anybody who is a director after they've been an actor, what did they learn about acting from being a director? And I'm curious what you have learned about teaching from your students.
Oh, gosh, I learn so much from them. I mean, it's almost overwhelming. I feel as though that's what being a teacher really is. Being a teacher is really about being a provocateur. Hmm. I'm the instigator. My job is just to come up with really interesting challenges. And then I am actually as surprised as they are by the range of solutions they come up with. In fact, I rarely give the same assignment twice. First of all, it keeps me on my toes. I constantly have to be coming up with new ideas for new challenges. But also, I don't want to be anchored by what I've seen before. So I'm constantly learning from them. I'll give you just a simple example. And this one is a pretty well-known example because it's the opening story in What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20. And it's about a project I give the students where I give them, it's quite funny. I'm going to sort of double click on this for a second. I gave this assignment once. But it has sort of gone around the world, and many people give this assignment all the time. And I'll tell you the funny thing about that is then they write to me and ask me about the nuances of the assignment and all the rules. And I say, I didn't have any rules. It was one assignment, which was one sentence. And I just wanted to be surprised by what happened, and I never did it again. Mm. And the assignment was that the students were given $5 and 2 hours. And their challenge was to make as much money as possible, starting with $5 in 2 hours. Now, I knew that you could do something, right? You could have a car wash or a lemonade stand or, you know, a bake sale, right? So I knew you could do something. There was something you could do. And I really didn't think long and hard about what the possibilities were. So there were the obvious things that people could do with $5 in 2 hours. But then the students pushed way beyond what I even imagined, because the students realized that many of the teams realized that the $5 was actually a limitation and that their skills were worth much, much more than that $5. Hmm. And so those teams went out and figured out what sort of things they could do in 2 hours that were worth much more than $5. So setting up a bike tire pumping station in the middle of campus. And they started at the beginning asking for $1, and halfway through they started asking for donations, and after 2 hours they've made several hundred dollars.
Wow.
Okay, they're the team that ended up taking pictures at one of the school dances and, you know, sending it to them, sort of professional photos. Ah. There was a team that made reservations at all the popular restaurants in Palo Alto and started selling the reservations as the times came up. But the team that reframed the whole thing beautifully and went way beyond that realized that the $5 and the 2 hours were a limitation. And the most valuable thing they had was their 3-minute presentation time in class. And they sold that for $650 to a company that wanted to recruit the students.
Wow.
So the fact is, I learn a lot, right? I learned through that experience how, you know, they could really keep pushing. All I had to do was give them a provocative prompt. Uh-huh. This last quarter, I did something, so that seems, you know, sort of fun and a little bit, you know, playful. But this last quarter, we worked on a very profound project looking at the reentry process for people coming out of San Quentin prison. And so the students went to San Quentin. They worked with the inmates there. They met with people who were former prisoners. They met with parole officers, other people in that whole ecosystem, and came up with remarkable ideas about how one might totally redesign that very broken process of people getting out of prison and entering a life of freedom. Hmm.
Okay, so two sort of final questions for you. The first one is, you know, when you look back at the work that you've done, you know, having written kids' books, having done all the things you've done around teaching, I mean, do you have any sense of what sort of the underlying thread that ties your entire body of work together is?
Yeah, I'm very curious. In fact, I'd like to teach a class on curiosity. That's something that I've been trying to think about. How might I do that? What would that look like, a class on curiosity? I grew up in a home where curiosity was absolutely celebrated, and I am constantly motivated to ask questions and then figure out what the answers are. Hmm. And so it keeps me on my toes. I'm very comfortable being out of my comfort zone. And that's really what motivates me, is constantly pushing myself to learn more. You know, people often think that I'm very competitive. That couldn't be further from the truth. I'm very driven. I'm very driven. Uh-huh. I'm driven to keep pushing myself, but it does not at all have to do with anyone else's expense, at anyone else's expense. And in fact, one of my favorite things is helping other people. If I can help other people, I always do. And as I learned from my mother, who would always say to me, you know, what can I do to be helpful? That's one of my favorite things is, hey, what can I do to be helpful? And really interesting opportunities open when you're open to helping others and when you're curious.
Hmm. Well, Tina, this has been really, really great. So I want to close with my final question, which is how we finish all our interviews at Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Ha ha ha. What makes someone unmistakable? The thing that comes to my mind is authenticity. You really have to tap into what is really authentic to you. And isn't that great that it's different for all people? And that's what makes the world such an interesting place. It's very sad when there are people who are trying to be what they're not. And so I really, really strive to be as authentic as possible. And I try to encourage that of my colleagues and my students as well.
Hmm. Well, Tina, this has been just fabulous and very, very thought-provoking and insightful, as I expected it would be. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share some of your story and your insights with our listeners at The Unmistakable Creative.
You are so wonderful. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, my pleasure. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.